Chapter 6. Race and Intelligence. Few subjects are so difficult to discuss as race and intelligence, much less to discuss unemotionally, logically, or empirically. Even if the emotional or ideological aspects can be put aside, formidable analytical difficulties remain. Race is an elusive concept to apply in practice in today's genetically mixed populations, and intelligence is even more elusive. But because a discussion must proceed carefully and within limits, does not mean that it cannot proceed at all. Among the questions to be addressed are, 1. The existence, magnitude, and persistence of mental performance differences among racial and ethnic groups. 2. The reasons behind such differences, as these can be inferred from available evidence. 3. The reliability and validity of the instruments used to measure differences in mental performance. And 4. The social implications of these issues. Gross differences. Questions of group differences in mental performance have existed long before IQ tests or other modern devices appeared. Cicero warned his fellow Romans not to buy British slaves, for he found them unusually difficult to teach. While some would consider such an assessment as mere evidence of bias or racism, there is no a priori reason to dismiss Cicero's first-hand observations on the strength of general presumptions among those 20 centuries removed from the facts. Indeed, much of what is known of the cultural and technological gulf between the tribal Britons of that era and the more advanced civilization existing on the continent of Europe would tend to support Cicero's conclusion of differences in mental performance at that time. Whether those differences were genetic is another question entirely. Despite much controversy over what specifically constitutes intelligence, it is generally agreed that it has more than one dimension. Various kinds of mental performance can therefore be compared among nations and groups, each performance being considered a facet of intelligence. This is sufficient for a discussion of gross differences, even if it does not identify which elements are central or essential to intelligence. Results on a variety of tests, for example, may therefore be indicative without pretending to be definitive. For purposes of gross comparisons, these can include tests usually called achievement tests, as well as others conventionally labeled aptitude or intelligence tests. The question as to how different and how sharply demarcated these tests are from one another need not be debated here, nor the larger question as to how well the results of any of them correspond in practice to what they are designed to measure in theory. For present purposes, they are all simply attempts to measure various aspects of mental performance, intelligence in a very general sense. International comparisons. Modern international patterns of differences in mental test performance tend to follow patterns already noted in economic and demographic areas. Just as Northern European societies and their offshoots, such as Australia or the United States, together with westernized Japan, tend to form one group with similar incomes and fertility rates, so they are also clustered together on mental test results. Traditional Latin American, Asian, and Middle East societies tend to differ significantly from them in mental test results, as in income and fertility. The science test scores of 14-year-olds around the world illustrate this. Modern or westernized nations and their mean scores. Australia, 24.6. England, 21.3. Japan, 31.2. Sweden, 21.7. United States, 21.6. West Germany, 23.7. Traditional Asian, Middle East, Latin American nations and their mean scores. Chile, 9.2. India, 7.6. Iran, 9.4. Thailand, 15.6. No one has to believe that an understanding of science is hereditary in order to believe that it is economically and socially significant. It is one of a number of cultural differences that have consequences. There are both international and intergroup differences on other mental tests, including IQ tests. This is hardly surprising, since results on various standardized mental tests tend to have significant correlations with one another, whether these are called achievement tests or intelligence tests. For example, the Japanese population as a whole scored higher on one mathematical test than did any other population, as they did in science. Those scores were England, 19.3, Finland, 24.1, Japan, 31.2, United States, 16.2. Intergroup comparisons. Intergroup differences in mental test performance within a given country can also be substantial. A 1981 study of scholastic aptitude test score differences among American ethnic groups showed a range of more than 100 points in average verbal scores among half a dozen groups, and a range of more than 150 points in average mathematics scores among the same groups. Differences were especially dramatic at the higher levels. More Asian American students scored above 700 on the mathematical portion of the SAT than all the Black, Mexican American, Puerto Rican, and American Indian students put together, even though more than three times as many students from these latter groups took the same test. Nor did these intergroup differences represent simply differences in socioeconomic background. Asian American students from families with incomes of $6,000 or less scored higher on the mathematics portion of the SAT than Black, Mexican American, or American Indian students from families with income of $50,000 or more. Such patterns are not peculiar to the United States. In the British colony of Hong Kong, Chinese school children outperformed the English school children on nonverbal tests, despite the higher socioeconomic level of the English in Hong Kong. The Chinese also outperformed the Malays in Singapore and the Indonesians in Indonesia. If intergroup differences on test performances cannot be explained away simply by socioeconomic factors, neither can they be wholly attributed to educational differences. An international survey of scores on the Porteous-Mayes test among illiterate adults showed striking differences among various groups, whether living at home or abroad. Among Indians in colonial Malaya, for example, Tamils had higher scores than Gurkhas, and both had higher scores than Bengalis in Bengal. The same study also included African Bushmen, Chinese, and others. Although this survey was conducted entirely among illiterates, so that differences in quantity or quality of education are not a factor, the differences between the average scores of the top group and the bottom group, both from India, were even greater than the equivalent IQ differences between blacks and whites in the United States, where large educational differences between the races have long existed. The question here is not whether these differences are cultural or genetic in origin. The point is that they are real and that their consequences are real. All differences between groups that are genetically different are not genetic differences. Some groups have more children than others, for example, and children from large families generally tend to score lower on mental tests than children from smaller families. There are, of course, numerous other non-genetic differences between groups who differ genetically. One of the first massive exercises in group mental testing was conducted among soldiers in the U.S. Army during World War I. Many were immigrants, and their average test scores varied according to their respective homelands. The proportions of soldiers with different ancestries who exceeded the American national norms were as follows: English, 67%, German, 49%, Irish, 26%, Russian, 19%, Italian, 14%, Polish, 12%. Civilian mental tests in the U.S. from the same period tended to show intergroup differences very similar in ranking and magnitude. While the English and Germans in the United States tended to equal or exceed the national IQ norm of 100, Americans of Italian, Slovak, Greek, Portuguese, Polish, Croatian, Spanish, and Lithuanian ancestry all averaged in the 80s. In these studies of civilians, Black Americans' average IQ was in the same range as these latter European groups, and above some of these European groups, but Blacks scored below all the Europeans on the U.S. Army mental tests. The civilian tests were conducted primarily in the northern cities, where the various immigrant groups were concentrated, and northern Blacks have historically had higher IQs than southern Blacks. The U.S. Army sample was more representative of the national distribution of Blacks at that time, overwhelmingly southern. This also illustrates the difficulties of trying to separate hereditary and environmental influences. Northern Negroes at this period of history differed both genetically and culturally from Southern Negroes. Substantial intergroup IQ differences have been common in other countries. The Black-White IQ difference of about 15 points in the U.S. has been matched by the IQ difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews in Israel, or between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. Nor are such IQ differences limited to different racial or ethnic groups. Some Appalachian mountain communities have had average IQs in the mid-80s in the United States, as have some canal boat communities in Britain. So have inhabitants of the Hebrides Islands off Scotland. In Indonesia, residents of Java score higher than Indonesians living in the outer islands, and women score higher than men. In China, low-income and rural youngsters score lower on examinations. First-born children in general tend to score higher on mental tests and do better in school than later children in the same families. Moreover, mental test patterns within a given race vary considerably when the environments are quite different. Blacks in rural Georgia, for example, as compared to blacks in California. Selectivity bias. A complicating factor in both intergroup and international comparisons is that different proportions of each group and nation receive different quantities and qualities of schooling. In underdeveloped countries, less than 5% of the eligible age cohort received higher education in 1975, compared to 23% in the more developed countries, and there were further large variations within each of these broad categories. Nearly half the relevant age cohort in North America was enrolled in higher education, compared to 17% in Europe, 6% in Asia and Latin America, and less than 2% in Africa. Therefore, tests given at a particular age or point in the educational process may be testing a more highly selected sample in one country or group than in another. However, the large test score differences among illiterates from different groups suggest that educational selectivity can by no means be considered a sufficient explanation. Moreover, groups underrepresented in higher education, such as blacks, Hispanics, or American Indians in the United States, often score lower than groups overrepresented, such as Asian Americans, though the selectivity factor alone would suggest the reverse. A long decline of American student scores on the Scholastic Aptitude Test from the mid-1960s to the early 1980s has sometimes been attributed to an increase in the number of minority or disadvantaged children taking such tests, corresponding to their increased representation at American colleges during the 1960s and 1970s. Changing selectivity is thus blamed for lowering the average performance statistically, when the performance may not have been lowered, in fact, among those previously taking such tests. In reality, however, the number of scores in the top brackets declined absolutely and substantially. About 12,000 American youngsters scored 750 or higher on the mathematics SAT in 1976, but this declined to about 6,500 by 1981. Similar declines occurred on biology, French, and German tests, and even more drastic declines occurred among those scoring in the top bracket on English composition. In short, changing selectivity cannot explain the decline in American SAT scores, which occurred at the top as well as in the rest of the distribution. Ironically, the small upturn in test scores in the 1980s was due largely to small improvements among black and other minority students. Implications. A definitive study of intergroup or international differences in mental test performance would have to take into account not only selectivity bias, but also many other factors, perhaps too many to be manageable. What is sufficient at this point is to establish that such differences are real, that they are common, that they are large, and that they are consequential. In this respect, they are like other behavioral differences in family patterns, eating patterns, work patterns, and other cultural traits. The implications of international and intergroup differences in mental test performance for the heredity environment controversy can be analyzed after first considering the internal patterns of mental test scores, as distinguished from their general levels, and after considering the degree to which mental test score differences between groups persist or change over time. Patterns of differences. Intergroup differences exist not only on overall mental test scores, but also on internal patterns of strengths and weaknesses on different parts of mental tests. Questions involving three-dimensional conceptions of space, for example, tend to be especially difficult for African youngsters and also for Jamaicans. By contrast, these are the kinds of questions on which Hong Kong Chinese children outperformed the English children in Hong Kong and outperformed children in such other places as Scotland or India. But Eskimo youngsters did even better than Chinese on such questions. In the United States, the Chinese did better than either Jews or blacks on spatial conceptions. Differences in spatial perceptions have been linked empirically to differences in body chemistry. Whether these in turn are linked to genetic differences, and whether these differ significantly by race, are separate questions. considering how relatively recently in its long history Western civilization acquired its current conception of three-dimensional perspective, it can hardly be surprising that similar concepts are not uniformly perceived within or between other cultures. Regardless of whether this difference in three-dimensional perception is genetic or cultural, it is real. For some purposes, its genetic or cultural origin may not matter. For others, it may. Jews obviously do not suffer unduly because the profile of their abilities dips in the spatial conception area. But what is central here, as elsewhere, is that groups have their own distinctive patterns. Chinese, Puerto Rican, Negro, and Jewish youngsters in New York have each had different profiles of mental test strengths and weaknesses, quite aside from different levels of overall test scores. Very similar patterns were found among children from the same respective groups in Boston. Moreover, those from families at higher socioeconomic levels had essentially the same test score patterns as poorer members of their respective groups, but at higher levels. Low overall test scores for particular groups are often blamed on cultural bias in the tests, and in particular on the use of words or information more likely to be familiar to some groups, such as white, middle-class test takers in the United States. Examples of such material are not difficult to find on some tests, including both achievement and intelligence tests. But most critics who argue this way often fail to ask whether, in fact, it is these kinds of questions which account for the low overall scores of groups who do poorly. Almost invariably, low-scoring groups do their worst on nonverbal questions, on abstractions that do not require middle-class vocabulary or information. This does not prove that cultural bias is not present, but it does indicate that any such bias must take a very different form from what is usually assumed or portrayed. The pattern of low-scoring groups doing their worst on abstract questions is neither new nor limited to today's low-scoring groups. A 1917 study of various immigrant groups tested at Ellis Island as they arrived in the United States showed the low-scoring groups among them doing particularly poorly on abstract questions. This confirmed an earlier 1913 observation by noted psychologist H. H. Goddard, who had tested such groups there. These people cannot deal with abstractions. A similar judgment was voiced by L. M. Terman, creator of the Stanford-Binet IQ test, who studied low-scoring racial minorities in the southwestern United States and concluded that these groups cannot master abstractions. A 1932 study of white children in isolated mountain communities in the U.S. showed that they not only had low IQ scores overall, but were especially deficient on questions involving abstract comprehension. Black-white mental test score differences are likewise greatest on abstract questions. Similar patterns have been common in other countries and cultures as well. A study in England, for example, showed that rural working-class boys trailed their urban peers more on abstract questions than on other kinds of questions. In the Hebrides Islands, where the average IQ of the Gaelic-speaking children was 85, the same as among blacks in the United States, the Gaelic-speaking youngsters did well on informational items, but trailed their English-speaking classmates most on items involving such abstractions as time, logic, and other nonverbal factors. In Jamaica, where IQs average well below normal, the lowest performance was on the least verbal test. In short, despite the verbal and informational biases of many mental tests, low-scoring groups tend to do their worst on nonverbal and non-informational, i.e., abstract questions. This seems to hold true across racial lines, though of course the incidence of low scores differs from one racial or ethnic group to another. Nonverbal questions are not necessarily less culturally biased. On the contrary, cultures seem to differ greatly in their reaction to abstractions. Indian children being tested in South Africa were reported as showing a lack of interest in nonverbal materials. West African boys obviously became bored with abstract questions, according to observers, and their scores fell when retested on such items, reinforcing the inference that boredom was a factor in the results, since greater familiarity would otherwise tend to raise scores on the second testing, while boredom would tend to be worse on a second attempt. American Negro soldiers tested during World War I tended to lapse into inattention and almost into sleep during abstract tests, according to observers. Lower-class youngsters in Venezuela were described as non-starters on one of the well-known abstract tests used there. Inhabitants of the Hebrides likewise gave evidence of not being fully oriented toward such questions. In short, there is reason to doubt whether various groups apply themselves equally to abstract thought. If there is a significant difference in interest and application, then differences in results do not carry the same weight as evidence of underlying potential. Moreover, even if it were possible to galvanize everyone to the same pitch of effort on a given occasion for testing, this would still not eliminate the effects of prior years of differences in interest in the development of their abilities in that direction. For many practical purposes, however, it makes no real difference whether poor performances in abstract thinking are due to neglect or to lack of capacity. In either case, it has serious ramifications in a scientific and technological society. Persistence of differences. Thus far, the discussion has made no attempt to distinguish between hereditary and environmental causes of the differences between groups in the level or pattern of their mental test scores. The persistence of these levels and patterns over time may also be either hereditary or environmental. However, to the extent that intergroup rankings change over time without significant changes in the genetic composition of the respective groups, such changes are more readily reconcilable with environmental rather than hereditary causes. While international comparisons make it possible to see the persistence of group patterns under a wide variety of circumstances at a given time, it is more difficult to make comparably wide comparisons over time because mental tests themselves are only about a century old in most of the world, though civil service examinations are many centuries old in China, and the era of mass testing has been only a few decades long. Nevertheless, within these limitations, it is possible to investigate what has happened. The massive mental testing of American soldiers during the First World War provides one starting point for measuring persistence and change in mental test results. A similar massive mental testing of American soldiers in the Second World War permits a rare comparison at an interval of a quarter of a century, during an era when there were significant social and educational changes in the United States, not the least of which was the ending of large-scale immigration and the consequent acculturation of existing immigrant groups. The amount of schooling also rose for the general population. The differences observed after these social changes were striking. The mental test scores of American soldiers during World War II averaged higher than in World War I by the equivalent of from 12 to 14 IQ points. While such an IQ difference between two individuals would not be startling, this is a very substantial difference between averages for large groups. It is comparable to the difference between the IQ norm of 100 and the average IQ of various low-scoring groups around the world. Moreover, a very similar pattern of substantial test score increases has occurred in other countries, such as Holland, Japan, West Germany, Australia, and France. Clearly, the average mental performance of millions of people can change significantly over time. A more directly relevant question, in the context of heredity environment issues, is that of the relative rankings of particular groups, and how these persist or change over time. World War I soldiers in the U.S. Army who had immigrated from Russia, Italy, and Poland had the three lowest mental test score averages among European immigrant groups, and not appreciably higher than the mental test scores of American Negroes. Because most immigrants from Russia and Poland during this era were Jews, the distinguished mental test specialist Carl Brigham, creator of the Scholastic Aptitude Test, concluded that the results disprove the popular belief that the Jew is highly intelligent. Yet within a decade, Jewish IQ scores were above the national average, where they have remained. Brigham later recanted the general conclusions of his earlier study as being without foundation. This was an era of rapid socioeconomic rise for Jews and of their rapid acculturation to American society. But it was not an era of large-scale intermarriage of Jews with other groups in the United States. The dramatic changes among American Jews were environmental, not genetic. Italian Americans and non-Jewish Polish Americans likewise experienced significant changes in mental test scores over the years. A survey conducted by this writer, with samples of more than 10,000 from each group, showed the following median IQ scores over a period of six decades. In the 1920s, Italian Americans' median IQ was 92, Polish Americans' median IQ was 91. In the 1930s, Italian Americans' median IQ was 93, Polish Americans' median IQ was 95. In the 1940s, Italian Americans' median IQ was 95, Polish Americans' median IQ was 99. In the 1950s, Italian Americans' median IQ was 99. Polish Americans' median IQ was 104. In the 1960s, Italian Americans' median IQ was 103. Polish Americans' median IQ was 107. In the 1970s, Italian Americans' median IQ was 100. Polish Americans' median IQ was 109. The rise in the IQs of Italians and Poles in the United States was even more dramatic than these data indicate. Both groups had average IQs of about 85 in civilian tests conducted around the time of the First World War. Their total rise in IQ from that time to the 1970s was 15 points or more. These were also groups with relatively low rates of intermarriage during the period of their IQ rise, so that this again largely represents a change in environment rather than genes. As in other areas, time in itself guarantees no progress, nor are trends always continuous. One of the most mixed pictures in mental test results is that among American Negroes. Black soldiers in World War II scored further behind white soldiers than in World War I. Yet a more recent study shows black orphans adopted by white families to have an average IQ of 106. Moreover, regional differences in IQ have been significant and persistent among blacks. Those in the South averaging about 80, and those outside the South averaging about 90. Regional differences also cut across racial lines. During World War I, for example, black soldiers from Ohio, Illinois, New York, and Pennsylvania scored higher on mental tests than white soldiers from Georgia, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Mississippi. While the test scores of whole nations may rise over time, they may also decline over time. Scholastic aptitude test scores dropped steadily for nearly two decades in the United States. A similar decline in academic standards occurred in China during the so-called Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. Despite large overall ideological differences between the two countries, some similar changes in educational practices occurred in both countries during their declines, notably a disavowal of objective standards, an emphasis on democratization of education, and a decline in the authority of teachers. The common practice in the United States of comparing blacks in isolation with the national average or with whites lumped together creates an illusion of group uniqueness that will not stand up under closer scrutiny, since the average IQ of American Negroes has been the same as that of a number of other groups with differing ancestries in countries around the world. The concentration of recent and bitter IQ controversies on black-white differences has led to a banning of group IQ tests in some American cities and to a widespread reluctance to publish such data. This has occurred at a time when a rising socioeconomic level among black Americans might lead to an expectation of a rise of IQ levels. The test scores of black students on the Scholastic Aptitude Test have in fact begun to rise, and since standardized test results tend to correlate with one another, an inference might be made about a corresponding rise in black IQs. But the ban on IQ testing and pressure against publication or discussion of interracial IQ differences make it unlikely that this inference can be tested in the near future. Ironically, black political leaders and spokesmen are among the strongest supporters of this suppression of evidence. The taboo against discussing race and IQ has not left this an open question. On the contrary, it has had the perverse effect of freezing an existing majority of testing experts in favor of a belief that racial IQ differences are influenced by genetics. No belief can be refuted if it cannot be discussed. Nor can any individual or society get the benefit of the clarification which often follows an attempt at refutation, whether that attempt proves to be successful or not. Heredity and environment. The relative influences of heredity and environment cannot logically be discussed in categorical terms, though this often happens in the heat of controversy. Just as the hereditary organization of the body is the mechanism by which food is converted into weight at a given level of physical activity, so the hereditary organization of the brain is the mechanism by which environmental stimuli are converted into intellectual results. To argue categorically as to which is more important is like arguing whether F or X is more important than the equation Y equals the product of F times the quantity X. The term F stands for the process by which X changes Y. In short, neither side can deny the effect of either factor, certainly not at the individual level. The real question is the incremental effect of a change of heredity or environment, given their existing combination, when comparing two groups. If the existing environment is intellectually stultifying, then an improvement in environment should improve intellectual performance more than if we began with a very stimulating environment. Conversely, individuals with very different hereditary potential should respond differently to the same environmental improvements. Because outcomes in both cases depend upon where we are to begin with, the effect of heredity and environment cannot be answered once and for all. The answer may be very different for the general society than for particular groups who begin with different combinations of environmental or hereditary factors. Policy issues. What the controversy over heredity and environment is trying to get at is whether existing differences among individuals and groups are due more to the hereditary or environmental differences between them. To this cognitive issue is often added the policy issue, whether socially feasible changes can affect some desirable educational outcomes. These same two questions have dominated those on both sides of the issue. The article by Professor Arthur Jensen of the University of California at Berkeley that set off the current controversy in 1969 was entitled, "How Much Can We Boost IQ and Scholastic Achievement?" His answer, long since lost in the swirl of controversy, was that the school performance of disadvantaged minorities could be raised considerably above their existing levels, that there were great and relatively untapped reservoirs of mental ability in the disadvantaged, which could be developed by using different teaching methods, but that he expected no comparable changes in IQ scores. It was the latter issue on which the battle was joined, and which has largely submerged the rest of the discussion. The enormous complexities of the issues involved require that both the cognitive issues and the policy issues be approached very carefully and systematically. What is at issue is not whether some races are good only to be hewers of wood and drawers of water, or not even good for slaves, as Cicero said of the Britons many centuries ago. What is at issue is, one, whether there are important differences in the level or pattern of mental capabilities between racial groups, and two, whether these differences are imprinted by differences in genes or differences in cultures. It seems difficult to deny the very existence of differences in levels or patterns of developed capabilities, whatever one's views on innate potential. When the Chinese tested in Hong Kong, Singapore, Boston, New York, and San Francisco repeatedly show a superior sense of spatial conception, it is difficult to deny that there is something there, whatever its origin might be. Professor Jensen believes that the origin is genetic, but his policy conclusions do not depend on that. When he urged that we further explore different types of abilities and modes of learning, and seek to discover how these various abilities can serve the aims of education, he was urging a course of action equally compatible with purely cultural differences in styles of thinking. In short, the issues are narrower in policy terms than in emotional or ideological terms. However many philosophic, political, or other overtones the heredity environment issue has acquired, it is ultimately an empirical question. Evidence, rather than preferences, are decisive. It is a question as to what sorts of evidence would be observed if one theory were correct, compared to what would be observed if the opposite theory were correct. Empirical evidence. If each group has a similar distribution of hereditary intellectual potential, something not directly observable, what is there that would be observable, and which would not be observable if groups differed in their respective distributions of genetic intellectual potential? There are a number of phenomena that would be observed in the one case, but not in the other. None of these is sufficiently ironclad as to be definitive, but if a significant number of them all point in the same direction, that may be indicative. If the differences between two groups are environmental rather than hereditary, then members of one group raised in the culture of the other should have an intellectual performance level more like their adopted group rather than their biological group. This is a pattern already noted in the case of black orphans raised by white families in the United States. A somewhat similar result has been found in the case of many children of unwed mothers in early post-war Germany, children sired by American soldiers in the army of occupation after World War II. There were no significant differences in the IQs of those sired by black soldiers from those sired by white soldiers. If substantial changes in mental performance are observed without corresponding genetic changes, This too would suggest environmental causes for the original differences, at least as regards those particular groups. This pattern has already been noted in the history of Jews, Poles, and Italians in the U.S., as well as in the substantial rise of raw test scores of whole nations around the world. One of the logical conclusions drawn by many early scholars, who believed in the overwhelming role of genetics in determining intelligence, was that the greater fertility of low IQ classes and races would mean a declining national IQ over time, as such groups became a rising proportion of the total population. Such predictions were made in Europe as well as America, and were falsified by the subsequent course of events in both places. Indeed, mental test norms have had to be adjusted upward to maintain national IQ averages at their definitional level of 100 points. This renorming has concealed some of the very large IQ test performance changes that have, in fact, occurred over time. Some research findings indicate that females are less susceptible to environmental influences than males are. Given that there are differences between groups in mental test performance, if these differences are environmentally caused, then the males of the low IQ group might be expected to have lower IQs than the females, who are less affected by environment. Conversely, if the differences between groups are hereditary, then the females of the low IQ group would be expected to have lower IQs than the males of the same group. Research findings have consistently shown black females to have higher IQ test scores and most other test scores than black males in the United States. The same was true among Jews when they scored low on mental tests in the past. However, among white-raised black orphans with an average IQ of 106, there was no female advantage, suggesting that the striking predominance of females among high IQ blacks is an environmental rather than a racial phenomenon. All these results suggesting environmental reasons for intergroup mental test differences conflict with a very large body of research findings for the general population. Studies of individual and social class variations in mental test results suggest just the opposite, that hereditary differences account for much more of the average IQ variation among individuals than do environmental differences in society at large. There is, however, no contradiction in the proposition that heredity may account for more variation within the general population, and environment for more of the variation between the general population and particular subgroups, especially when these subgroups are known to live under very different environmental conditions and to have a different cultural history as well. That is, incremental variations may be quite different in their effects on groups that are in very different environmental circumstances to begin with. There is no a priori reason why there must be a single answer as to the relative effects of heredity and environment. Moreover, the very general concept, environment, covers many specific things, not all of which have the effects attributed to them. For example, while test scores usually correlate with family income or parental occupations in the general population, such socioeconomic indicators do not explain many intergroup differences. The Chinese children tested in Hong Kong came from families less affluent than those of the English children whom they outperformed on nonverbal tests. In the United States, blacks of above-average socioeconomic status have not averaged as high IQ as whites of lower socioeconomic status, and neither blacks, Mexican Americans, nor American Indians from families with incomes of $50,000 and above scored as well on the quantitative portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test in 1981 as Asian Americans from families with incomes of $6,000 or less. The environment that matters for this purpose may be cultural rather than economic. Environment is not so much an answer as a gateway to further questions. It is a catch-all phrase for any of a vast number of unspecified non-genetic factors. In particular, environment cannot be confined to immediate surroundings, whether home, school, or neighborhood. Immigrant youngsters from various racial and cultural backgrounds, living in the same American neighborhoods and sitting side by side in the same schools, have had group IQ differences as great as those between residentially and educationally segregated blacks and whites in the southern United States. To salvage the environmental theory of IQ differences would require a much broader conception of environment, including cultural orientations and values going far back into history. But this broader conception of environment, reaching well beyond immediate circumstances, offers correspondingly less hope of substantial change by social engineering, such as remedial programs or the racial integration of schools. Test bias. Many of the leading tests used for selection purposes, whether in employment or in admissions to college or postgraduate education, have been challenged on the ground that these tests are invalid in general, or are invalid for socially disadvantaged racial or ethnic groups. More specifically, such tests are said to underestimate the true ability of the disadvantaged, and therefore to predict a lower future performance than will in fact occur. Such charges have been brought against IQ tests, the Scholastic Aptitude Test, civil service examinations, and many others. Long-continued and heated controversy over the predictive validity of mental tests is remarkable because, one, this is fundamentally an empirical question whose answer can be determined by a review of readily available facts, and, two, innumerable studies have been done over the years testing the predictive validity of a wide variety of well-known tests. Moreover, those who have the responsibility for making selections and those who have to live with the consequences of the selections they have made usually have a choice as to whether or not to use mental tests, which ones to use, and how much weight to give them. Alternative criteria and methods are also usually available to them, to use as complements to or substitutes for mental tests. Nevertheless, the predictive validity of mental tests has become a political issue, reaching to the highest levels of government in the United States, and a legal issue fought out again and again in the U.S. Supreme Court. Empirical evidence. There has been a huge accumulation of evidence on the correlation between test scores and subsequent performances, not only for the general population, but also for particular racial and ethnic minorities. Repeatedly, it has been demonstrated that the standard mental tests do not underestimate the subsequent performance of low-scoring minorities. They have, in fact, a slight tendency to do the opposite, to predict for low-scoring minorities a higher subsequent performance than that actually achieved. This pattern has been persistent over time and is international in scope. In the Philippines, for example, students from low-income and rural backgrounds have not only had lower-than-average test scores, but have also done worse academically at the University of the Philippines than other students with the same low test scores. In Indonesia, where men have averaged lower test scores than women, men with the same test scores as women have done poorer academic work than women at the University of Indonesia. Numerous studies show similar patterns between blacks and whites in the United States. Blacks tend to score lower than whites on a variety of aptitude, academic achievement, and job tests. But even when comparing blacks and whites with the same test scores, the subsequent performance of blacks tends to be lower, whether academically or on the job. This includes academic performance in colleges, law schools, and medical schools, and job performance in the civil service and the Air Force. Faced with massive evidence that applicants who score low on entrance examinations generally perform less well as students, some critics of standardized tests claim that this is still no indication as to the ultimate criterion, performance in later life. Almost never are such assertions accompanied by empirical evidence of greater predictability of later life performance from alternative measures of ability. Neither for minorities nor for the general population is there a perfect correlation between test scores and future performance, so anecdotal examples of exceptions abound. Moreover, there is no scientific way to determine whether a given correlation is high or low. The relevant decision-making question is, higher or lower than what alternatives? Assessing the prospects of human beings has never been a science, nor is politicizing it likely to add to its precision. Most of the controversies are not even conducted in empirical terms. From the cultural bias of particular questions, the use of words or assumption of information, more likely to be known by middle-class members of the larger society, it is often concluded that such tests must underestimate the true ability of disadvantaged groups. The plausibility of this reasoning is often used as a substitute for empirical verification of the conclusion. The nebulous concept of real ability is seldom specified as to whether it means, one, innate potential, which is unknowable, or two, developed capabilities existing at the time of testing, but incorrectly assessed by the test. If the latter, then the empirical basis of the correct assessment need only be specified, and the greater predictive validity of alternative methods demonstrated by a higher correlation with subsequent performance. Nothing of the sort has been done. In both political and legal processes, merely casting doubt on mental tests can create huge costs for those who use them. The cost of a relatively simple validation study under favorable conditions has been estimated at between $40,000 and $50,000. Differential validation for separate racial or ethnic groups could cost much more. The imposition of such costs, in turn, becomes an incentive for the institution using tests to abandon the tests or to set aside their results in the case of particular groups. This is, of course, precisely the result desired by many group activists. With such large rewards available merely for producing plausible and vehement objections to tests, it is hardly surprising to find what one leading authority has called endless streams of counterarguments, quibbles, and debating points. What is crucial to this process is that, 1, the burden of proof is put on the accused at very high cost, that, 2, without sufficient sample sizes in all the relevant categories, nothing can be proved, and that, 3, some American judges accept the premise that disparate results by group imply institutional discrimination. These political and legal circumstances have more to do with the persistence of the controversy than any ambiguity in empirical evidence. Group representation. Political pressures for increased representation of academically low performance groups in institutions of higher learning has existed in communist nations like the USSR and China, as well as in democratic nations such as India or the United States, and in fact in countries scattered around the world, from Nigeria to Fiji to England. Sometimes the low performance group is the majority population, as in Malaysia or Sri Lanka. Sometimes it is some minority group, untouchables in India or blacks in the United States, for example. Usually the low performance group seeks out the less demanding colleges or universities, and then the less demanding fields within given institutions. Untouchables in India do both, as do Mexican Americans in the United States, Sephardics in Israel, and many others. When top-level institutions seek greater numerical representation of low-scoring groups, they face severe problems in trying to get students at all comparable academically to their regular student body. This is especially so at elite institutions. When one group has a higher mean test score than another, the disparity between the representation of the two groups becomes progressively more extreme at higher and higher test score levels. Even within the black American population, for example, a relatively minor difference of a few points in average IQ score between men and women translates into a several hundred percent overrepresentation of black women relative to black men at high IQ levels. A similar pattern can be seen between blacks and whites, or between other groups. While the average Asian American student in 1981 scored a modest 30 points higher than the average white student on the mathematics portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test, 513 versus 483. More than twice as high a proportion of Asian Americans as whites had mathematics SAT scores of 700 and over. At the extremely high test score levels prevailing at elite American academic institutions, blacks are very rare. For example, many leading American colleges have student bodies whose average Scholastic Aptitude Test scores, verbal and quantitative combined, add up to 1,200 points or more. These include not only the obvious examples like Yale, Stanford, or Chicago, but also numerous lesser-known colleges like Davidson, Pomona, St. John's, Middlebury, Harvey Mudd, Carleton, and many others. However, blacks who meet these standards are relatively rare. There were fewer than 600 black students in the entire country with combined SAT scores of 1,200 in 1983, compared to more than 60,000 whites. The 8 Ivy League colleges alone could absorb every black undergraduate in the United States who scored over 1,200 and still have blacks statistically underrepresented in the Ivy League. Statistics are at least equally grim for the minority pool of applicants available to leading American engineering schools. There are about a dozen engineering schools in the United States where the average mathematics score alone on the Scholastic Aptitude Test is over 700 out of a possible 800. There were fewer than 200 black or Mexican American students who scored at that mathematics level in 1985, fewer than 100 Puerto Ricans, and fewer than 50 American Indians. Even if all the students at the 700 mathematics level applied to engineering schools, all four groups would still be grossly underrepresented in engineering schools, for together their pools included fewer than 500 students, compared to more than 3,600 among Asian Americans. Similar patterns are found in postgraduate education. A score of 650 or above on the quantitative portion of the graduate record examination is common at top-rated American graduate schools in either the physical or the social sciences, but there were fewer than 150 black students in the entire country who met this standard in 1978 through 79. For top American law schools, a common threshold was a score of 600 on the law school aptitude test in the 1970s and a college grade point average of 3.25. Only 39 black students in the country met those standards in 1976. Yet, in order to get a visible statistical representation of black students, far more blacks than this were admitted by these law schools. The net result, at 10 top-rated American law schools, was that blacks constituted 7% of the student body, had LSAT scores averaging 144 points lower than those of their white classmates, entered law school with lower college grades than whites, and their law school grades were, on average, at the 8th percentile. The negative academic consequences of admitting particular groups of students on the basis of representation rather than qualifications is not confined to elite institutions or to black students. Elite institutions tend to take the lead in such policies, perhaps because of their visibility or because of their vast federal research grants, hundreds of millions of dollars at some institutions, which could be jeopardized by any charge of racial discrimination based on underrepresentation of minorities. But once these elite institutions begin to siphon off minority students who would otherwise qualify for admission to institutions at the second or third tier in terms of academic quality, these second and third tier institutions may end up with a conspicuous lack of minority students, unless they in turn also begin to admit minority applicants who fall below their normal admission standards. In a climate of opinion in which statistical underrepresentation is equated with discrimination, both in political and legal discourse, each tier of schools may in self-defense admit minority students it knows to be unable to keep up academically. Even if most minority students are able to meet the normal standards at the average range of colleges and universities, the systematic mismatching of minority students begun at the top can mean that such students are generally overmatched throughout all levels of higher education. Youngsters who could have succeeded at San Jose State University may be failing at Berkeley, while youngsters who could have succeeded at a community college are failing at San Jose State. Alternatively, a student who could have successfully carried out his plans to major in chemistry or physics at San Jose State may be forced to major in sociology in order to survive at Berkeley. In neither case does this imply that the students are unqualified in some absolute sense. They are mismatched institutionally. Prediction versus ability. There remains the curious question as to why tests whose cultural bias is apparent nevertheless do not underestimate the later performances of disadvantaged applicants, whether in school or at work. Performance involves much more than either innate ability or developed capacity, and there is no reason to expect these other factors to be evenly distributed among groups who behave differently in innumerable other aspects of life. If the degree of familiarity with middle-class words and information, for example, is a proxy for some of the attitudes, behavior, and experience affecting performance, then such questions may have predictive validity, even if the knowledge they test is as irrelevant as critics claim. More generally, the predictive validity of any criterion, whether mental test scores, a criminal record, or marital status, does not depend upon the direct or obvious relevance of the criterion in question. If married men generally make significantly better insurance salesmen than single men, then this empirical generalization may be useful in employment selections, whether or not anyone knows why, and even if the marriage of existing single men for the sake of their careers would not improve their salesmanship in the slightest. If there are general differences in attitudes or behavior between those men who get married and those who do not, then some of these differences may affect their salesmanship, whether or not anyone knows specifically what such differences are. The predictive validity of a given criterion is an empirical question, not a question of plausibility or of demonstrated causation. Many who express great misgivings at leaving decision-makers free to use tests as they see fit overlook the fact that these are seldom unconstrained decisions. Competition imposes powerful penalties for being wrong and offers high rewards for being right. The variation in decision-making processes among competing institutions subjects all standards to competitive stress and weeding out. Yale University cannot simply give in to inertia or fads in its admissions policies if that gives Harvard a competitive edge in recruiting from the same pool of students. Still less can the Chrysler Corporation become capricious or self-indulgent in its hiring standards and hope to survive in competition with General Motors or with Japanese or European automobile manufacturers. The only people who can afford to make decisions without fear of consequences beforehand and without being forced to correct mistakes afterwards are precisely those third-party observers whom critics turn to, judges, politicians, and bureaucrats. Those who criticize tests as culturally biased often argue for the creation of culture-free tests or culture-fair tests. But if cultures are particular ways of accomplishing important human functions, then it would be an incredible coincidence if all cultures were equally efficient in all things. Massive cultural borrowings throughout history and around the world suggest that they are not. Moreover, since there are no culture-free societies, all performances will be performance in some given culture, so that attempts to predict performance are therefore attempts to predict what will happen within a particular cultural context. For a culture-free test to do this seems almost a contradiction in terms. To be culturally fair seems even more nebulous, a confounding of prediction and morality. Presumably, a culturally fair test would produce a similar distribution of results from peoples of different cultures. However much this might conform to the beliefs, desires, or philosophy of observers, it is not at all clear what practical purpose it would serve. Where the purpose is not to predict consequences in education or employment, but to assess innate potential, then culture-free test results might have some value as pure information or for psychological, political, or ideological purposes. However, culture-fair tests would lack even this effect if their very construction and validation were based on creating a preconceived distribution of results. The same objection applies to tests designed to cause disadvantaged minorities to outscore the general population. If the purpose of such tests is to demonstrate that any results desired can be produced by a change of questions, then such tests successfully accomplish this trivial purpose. However, tests do not exist for their own sake, but for what they attempt to predict about behavior outside of tests. The relevant standard for alternative tests, or for non-test criteria, is a better record of prediction. Few critics seem to want to meet that standard, and few alternative criteria, interviews, recommendations, etc., demonstrate as high a predictive validity as tests. Some of the empirical correlations between test scores and subsequent performance may seem quite modest. However, once again, the relevant comparison is not between the actual and the ideal, but between one predictive device and its alternatives. Moreover, test score correlations are complicated by the fact that many studies of correlation are based on samples drawn from institutions with a relatively narrow range of scores. There is little, if any, data on how well students with below-average mathematics scores perform at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, for example, because such students are unlikely to be admitted to MIT in the first place. Whether MIT students who score 775 on the mathematics SAT do appreciably better than those who score 750, the school average, is not a crucial indicator of predictive validity, just as measuring the performance of basketball players who are 7 feet tall against that of players who are 7 feet 2 inches tall will not prove whether height is important for basketball players. Some critics of standardized tests have, however, seized upon modest correlations in such settings to argue that tests are irrelevant. This argument is analogous to concluding that because 7 foot 2 inch basketball players may not perform substantially better than those in even 7 feet tall, it shows that people of normal height, or in principle, midgets, can generally play basketball as well as anyone, because height has little correlation with performance. Where such reasoning has been put into effect by lowering admissions standards for some lower scoring groups, the fallacy has often been exposed in ways painful to the individual and to the institution. At the University of the Philippines, for example, when students from rural and low-income backgrounds were admitted with somewhat lower qualifications than other applicants, one, nearly half shifted out of their originally chosen majors or were forced out by poor performance, two, four-fifths eventually dropped out of the university entirely, and three, the remaining fifth averaged lower grades than their classmates. Similar results have been found for untouchables in India, and for blacks in the United States. Viewing standardized tests instrumentally, the relevant criteria are the costs and benefits of such tests compared to alternative selection methods. If a modest correlation between test scores and grades increases the proportion of students who complete a given college from 80% to 95%, then saving the costs wasted on the 15% who would otherwise have dropped out may repay the costs of testing several times over. Additional benefits include a higher proportion of top achievers. Whatever the figures may be in a particular case, the question is not whether tests produce high or low correlations, but whether whatever correlation it has is sufficient to produce savings sufficient to cover its costs. These savings and these costs may be in money terms or in broader terms, but the basic trade-off remains the same in principle. The special case of Orientals. The spectacular rise of Japan from wartime devastation to economic and technological eminence in the post-war era, the similar upsurge of South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan in recent years, and the remarkable achievements of Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Vietnamese students in the United States have all served to revive genetic theories of intelligence. These racial theories now ascribe genetic superiority to Orientals, defined as people indigenous to the region north of the Himalayas and east of the Caucasus, rather than to Asians, defined in broader geographical terms to include Indians, Malays, or Indonesians as well. Among the evidence cited have been higher IQ or other test scores in Japan or among people of Chinese, Japanese, or other Oriental or Asian ancestry in the United States. Such claims have been carefully examined in detail by Professor James R. Flynn of the University of Otago in New Zealand in a way which is very revealing, not only as regards this particular issue, but also as regards the elusive and treacherous nature of statistics in general when used uncritically. A closer examination of national IQ data, which seemed to show Japan to have the highest IQ of any nation in the world, turned up problems in the selection of tests and in the selection of individuals tested, which were enough to cause the principal advocate of Japanese superiority to concede that the test scores reported should be revised downward. Moreover, since the issue raised was one of genetic or racial superiority, the relevant comparison was not simply between Japan and the United States, but between people of Japanese ancestry and white Americans. Here, the advantage of the Japanese in Japan over whites in the United States shrank to 3 points in IQ score, which is considerably less than the increase in IQ experienced by a number of nations over time, while those nations' racial composition remained more or less unaltered. If international IQ comparisons lent little support to the genetic theory of achievement differences, comparisons between Orientals and Caucasians within the United States dealt a real blow to the theory and to the whole relationship between IQ and achievement. Some of the test results, which seemed to show higher IQs among Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans than among white Americans, turned out, upon investigation, to be tests using obsolete norms, giving inflated IQ scores, or tests normed on a substandard local white population. A comprehensive survey of IQ studies over a period of several decades turned up no instance where Chinese or Japanese or Asian or Oriental Americans scored higher than the national average of white Americans. Often the racial differences in IQ were no more than one or a few points, but they invariably favored white Americans, often with the Orientals outperforming the whites on the nonverbal portions of the tests, and the whites outperforming the Orientals on the verbal portions. What makes these results in the United States momentous in their implications is that Chinese and Japanese Americans do in fact outperform white Americans, both academically and in the economy. Orientals or Asians as a group have higher grades in school and higher scores on such achievement tests as the widely used Scholastic Aptitude Test. They also have higher incomes and are much more highly represented in high-level occupations than are white Americans. In short, what has been claimed, erroneously, for blacks and other low-income minorities in the United States is in fact true for Asian Americans. Their subsequent academic and job performances exceed what their IQ test scores would predict. Among Chinese American and Japanese American school children born between 1945 and 1949, only half as high a proportion as among whites lagged behind the grade level appropriate for children their ages. Although a higher proportion of the students from these two groups ended up taking the Scholastic Aptitude Test than among whites, The Oriental students matched the scores of the white students, who were a smaller and presumably more select portion of the white student population as a whole. As for performance in later life, the average Chinese-American and Japanese-American earned an income earned only by white Americans with higher average IQs than their Oriental counterparts. Orientals in the United States were also better represented in high-level occupations than were white Americans, and the white Americans who reached these same occupational levels had higher average IQs than the Orientals who reached these levels. The general relationship between IQ and achievement, whether in school or in later life, has been well established by a number of studies. However, this general relationship does not apply to all groups, as the achievements of Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans demonstrate. But this general relationship cannot be simply waved aside whenever politically convenient, for the groups for whom it has been waved aside, notably blacks and other low-income minorities, are not the groups who demonstrate an ability to achieve beyond their IQ or other test score levels. Moreover, the remarkable achievements of people of Japanese ancestry, whether in Japan or in the United States, are clearly not due to racial superiority demonstrated on IQ tests, for that IQ advantage is very small in the case of the Japanese in Japan, and non-existent for Japanese Americans. Clearly, there are very large environmental factors at work, perhaps better described as cultural factors, to distinguish them from features of the immediate surroundings, as measured by conventional indices of socioeconomic conditions. Although these cultural advantages do not apply today to low-income minorities, the large impact of cultural factors argues against any claim that low-income groups are doomed to remain where they are. Moreover, the importance of cultural factors, expressed in such mundane things as longer hours devoted to homework, points in the direction from which improvement can come. Implications. Among the innumerable capabilities which all human societies require, many are mental capabilities. If all these developed mental capabilities were, at all times, evenly distributed among all racial and ethnic groups, it would be a remarkable exception to the striking differences found among these groups in almost every other aspect of their behavior. But to say that there are intergroup differences in particular mental skills at a given time is not to say that groups that excel at some skills excel at all skills, so as to create general superiority or inferiority, much less that skill levels or patterns remain fixed over time, or are genetic in origin. Although the discussion of intelligence has been almost exclusively in terms of mental tests, this has been a matter of convenience, rather than importance. It is by no means established that mental tests have been devised for all or most of the vast spectrum of human skills. Even activities normally thought of as physical have mental dimensions that can make major differences in outcomes. Farming, for example, has long been thought of as a physical activity with no mental dimension, and the peasant has often been depicted as an utterly stupid creature, a brother to the ox, in one classic poem. Yet groups with striking success in intellectual activities have often floundered or failed in agriculture, not from inability to meet its physical demands, but because of damaging errors or ineptitude in managing farms. Baron de Hirsch's far-flung agricultural colonies for Jews in the Western Hemisphere experienced many such difficulties, as did the farms of 19th-century German immigrant intellectuals, derisively called Latin farmers in the United States, because they often knew that ancient language, but understood little about farming. Like farming, sports are often thought of as having only physical demands. But the importance of the mental dimension of most sports is indicated by the fact that few athletes reach their performance peak at their physical peak, around age 18, but more usually 5 to 10 years later, when they are more seasoned and experienced, smarter, in a word. The kind of split-second decision-making, often in mid-air, required of a basketball player in the midst of frantic efforts by opposing players and teammates, is obviously quite different from the kind of scholarship which may take years to produce a book. But to be an outstanding basketball player means to outthink opponents consistently in these split-second decisions under stress. Is it coincidence that the fields dominated by black Americans, basketball, jazz, running backs, and football, all have this improvisational decision-making with numerous factors being decided in an instant under emotional pressure? Perhaps, and perhaps not. Whether it is genetic or a cultural style is even more problematical. Existing knowledge of the structure and nature of intelligence is far too preliminary to answer many of the questions raised about race and mental potential. The more immediate practical use of mental tests as aids to prediction raises fewer and more limited questions. The relevant issue is not how accurate the predictions are on some absolute scale, or even relative to predictions in other fields, such as economics or weather forecasting. The question is whether alternative means of accomplishing the same tasks as mental tests have as good a record. The evasion of this crucial empirical question has been a consistent pattern among critics of mental testing. Among American colleges and universities, the range of institutional test score averages is enormous. Scores on the quantitative portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test, for example, range from an average of 750 at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the California Institute of Technology to less than 300 at Cheney University. Tests are used not merely to determine who is qualified to go to college, almost everyone is somewhere in the vast range of American colleges, but to attempt to match the level of performance of individuals and institutions. The variance of test scores at a given institution may be relatively small compared to the variance among college students as a whole. This means that predictions of individual performance rankings at given institutions can be quite difficult when most of the students fall within a relatively narrow range. Factors such as attitude, discipline, and emotional state may become very important among students closely matched on mental test scores. In such a context, relatively modest correlations between score rankings and subsequent performance in college have caused some to dismiss the tests as irrelevant and to advocate opening admissions to applicants with far lower scores, especially when these students come from disadvantaged groups. Such practices have often led to disaster for both the individuals and the institutions. The many unanswered questions regarding race and intelligence do not mean that there are no answers at all. There are some important things already known, which at least limit the range of disagreement over empirical issues. Perhaps more significant, there are systematic analytical approaches which yield a measure of understanding, even if they do not yield the emotional satisfaction of categorical pronouncements.